Holy shit, Joe Kennedy.
Wow, Dave Gebro.
We are the hosts of Discography, the music podcast that delivers the objective truth about the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever existed.
All right, so here we are, back again, back in the studio cutting some episodes.
Cutting eps.
This one was particularly entertaining. You know, I'm kind of feel like I've been doing enough of these now where I'm kind of getting my groove on going with the... I'm not used to doing this kind of intent, scheduled listening. I'm used to kind of just throwing music on whenever I feel like listening to music.
It becomes intense. You know, we're starting to book guests, and now we have deadlines to listen to music.
Yeah,
that was
the before times how I listen to music. I guess
those days are over forever. Yeah. But you know, with these guys, with this artist we're doing tonight, you know, I knew the whole discography. Not many people do.
A lot of these were new on me, and I'm a big fan myself. But a lot of these were new on me as well.
A lot of them sit in a dark corner of his catalog that's not typically recognized.
But this is kind of one that's sort of this one was as a listening experience. This was mostly kind of sugar going down because even the records that aren't as strong are still kind of an interesting listen.
The good thing about the artists we're doing tonight is that the discography itself tells a very explicit story. From beginning to end, you really have a tale. There's a lot of takeaways from the tale. And, you know, often you do. I mean, you look at a song or an album that's really a snapshot in time and space. You look at an entire career, and it's going to tell you a story. And it's typically going to be very interesting regardless of the music.
This one also, you know, it's how much side eye do you get from your family when you're deep into some really obscure like album that nobody could ever care about?
You know, honestly, even if it's something that somebody could care about, the fact that it's so insistent and endless it's a harbinger of side eye at all times.
Yeah, I live kind of in a chronic state of side eye anyway.
Just
in life from all people I interact with.
The terrible thing is I either get side eye or if I'm in front of them I get stink eye.
Yeah, stink eye is just side eye without the
side eye in front.
Okay, well, should we get into the episode?
Probably.
Today, we will be in the train yards hitting up the cars with the spray paint on the career of Sly Stone.
Sly and the family.
Sly and the Family Stone.
But also Sly.
And
solo.
Also occasionally Sly Stone.
It became interchangeable, but I got to say, Joe, right off the bat, please, because it's the only way I'm going to be able to get rid of this nagging feeling. I'm nervous tonight. And by tonight, I mean this afternoon, because... This is a big mountain to climb.
It's a high stakes episode.
It really is.
There's so much music and insanity and storytelling. And
it's one of the great tales in rock/funk history. Sly and the Family Stone. So what we do is we are the only podcast that goes through an entire discography of an artist, and that includes not just albums but extended plays, if they're turning point singles, just everything that an artist has released, to get an overview of exactly what in the fuck is going on with that artist or band.
And I should note, we're not doing it from memory. We are, even though we are familiar with a lot of these artists' work, we are listening again with fresh ears to everything they ever did from the beginning to the end of their careers.
Our families have become strangers to us.
And I have no room for any other music other than the things that we listen to in this
show.
No
room for any other things, period.
So you're welcome.
Yes, exactly. We do the hard curating so you don't have to. Definitely follow along with us on discography.com to get a very finely curated playlist of everything that we're going through. To get a sense of an artist's full career and arc of their work.
But this will be everything you got to know about Sly and the Family Stone. We're doing the whole start to finish, and for every artist that we do on the show.
Sylvester Stewart was born on March 15th, 1943, in Denton, Texas, and then raised in Vallejo in the Bay Area. Dude was a prodigy at an early age and mastered tons of instruments, right, Joe? Just like you. Except he was more on the gospel end of things with Freddie and Rose, his brother and sister.
I do my thing, but Sly is a, you know, kind of Mozart level talent. You know, he's kind of like, you know, he's in the upper like stratosphere of raw musical talent with people like, you know, like Brian Wilson or Prince, or, you know, there are like four or five artists who are kind of the pillars of funk music.
But then he also, to me, when I think of him, he totally embodied the schism and the dichotomy of the 60s.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's that too with him. He's actually,
you know, freedom slash hedonism.
I think there's another layer to Sly's music is in that it's very honest and personal.
But he's also hiding inside of it.
Yeah.
There's places you can almost see him dart around. He's telling you the truth, then he's turning around like Eminem.
But
almost.
It's not really, it's not just party music. There is some party music in there, he's a pretty sophisticated lyricist. And I think underrated in that regard, really.
Definitely.
And, you know, the songs kind of have an extra layer of meaning on both ends of the spectrum. The really kind of like optimistic, you know, Rainbow Coalition kind of tunes. And then
they fucking go south so quick. And that's part of the appeal of the story.
But then both those things are kind of equally sincere.
Yeah, you know? So absolutely. He's always honest.
Contains multitudes.
So anyway, the most important thing to know about the early life of the Stewart family is that they were a very deeply religious middle-class clan. So the part of the belief system of what they subscribe to, the Church of God in Christ, their parents, Casey and Alpha, they encourage their kids to express themselves musically through the church. And go ahead, Joe.
So yeah, his brothers and sisters are, well, Freddie and
Rose.
And Rose are pretty badass in their own right. I mean, Freddie's phenomenal guitar player and singer. You know, I guess he's sort of the Carl Wilson of the Sly and the Family Stone.
That's a totally fair comparison.
A fine musician in his own right, and same with Rose. They're really like, you know, big personalities.
So they became, along with Loretta, their sister, they formed a group called the Stewart Four as kids, and they performed gospel music and in the church and recorded one of those gall darned 78 RPM singles in 1952. On the Battlefield, backed with Walking in Jesus' Name. That was the very, very first release. Not much of a big release, but what happened was, this is something that becomes intrinsic to the Sly story. Sylvester got the nickname Sly in grade school when a classmate just misspelled his name, Slyvester. And then since that moment, the nickname stuck, but actually wound up kind of creating this weird schism to his personality throughout his entire life.
Somehow Sylvester Stallone also got Sly as a nickname.
Yeah, yeah. I think he was
that
going
misspelling,
for...
That misspelling, like, it created a whole new genre of
instant
Sylvester nicknames.
Yeah. So, you know, Sylvester was the honest, true him, and Sly was like the devil on his shoulder. And this was something that... I would say, and very fairly, haunted him throughout his career.
Yeah, he didn't really oscillate between the two. He was kind of the one, and then like very much just the other.
Then only the other, except for like...
And then really the other.
And then, yeah, exactly. He joined a bunch of different high school bands, and one of them was a group called the Viscanes. So this was what I consider to be his first real group. It was a doo-wop group that featured his friend... Frank Arellano, a guy who was a Filipino, and the two of them were the only non-white performers, but the integrated group, however, you know, semi-integrated they were, made the Viscanes quote-unquote hip to the audience. And so they'd later inspire Sly's idea, the cross-cultural, you know, multiracial family stone thing.
And they're pretty good. It's kind of standard issue doo-wop, but it kind of has some grease to it. And
I like it.
He sings great on it. So I think it's quality for sure for what it is.
So we're talking 1961 to 62. Sly is not even singing, or let's say he doesn't have the lead on a lot of stuff, but right. Even that stuff is good.
Yeah. It sounds almost kind of like the particular brand of doo-wop that Zappa was really into.
That's true. It's a little Reuben and the Jetsy.
Yeah.
But it's good. It's you know, it's serviceable period doo-wop shamalam is what I've somehow reduced it to for whatever reason.
Yeah, I liked it.
It's, you know, not necessarily super exceptional, but at this point, Sly's only getting his feet wet. And it's definitely better than I feel it has any right to be, seeing as this could have been, you know, of historical interest only. I would give it 3 stars.
I didn't star this one, but okay, 3 stars. Right,
you did.
Top
star
of my head,
it, bro.
If I, yeah, okay,
you did star it. So then he was doing sort of like the first thing that comes to mind is the shit that Lou Reed was doing in the mid '60s for the Brill Building knockoff thing.
Yeah,
do the ostrich and stuff like that. So in '64, Sly Stewart came out with a single, "I Just Learned How to Swim," backed with "Scat Swim."
That's a pretty amazing title, Scat Swim.
It's awesome. It's very imagistic.
Yeah, it's a turd floating in a pool.
it's a Caddyshack reference.
This is sounding like in my notes it says like it was kind of like surf rock kind of kind of garage surf, like Dwayne Eddy kind of thing he's going for.
Yeah, and it works.
Yeah, again, it's you
good.
Know,
it's not as good as the Viscanes, I think. Because now he's like floating out in the water on his own, and he's kind of flailing.
It's also,
to find
I think
he
he's trying to a couple of different things. There's that other song, Buttermilk, from this period.
Right, right. This is the next year. We're in 1965.
Well, that one's kind of more like a Booker T and the MGs kind of.
It's
like
even called Buttermilk Part One. Don't friggin' forget that, Joe.
I guess there's no kinda about it.
Then the back of the single was Temptation Walk, right, which sounds similarly Booker T and the MGs.
Yeah.
And then he did a song called Dance All Night with his brother Freddie, who was soon to be his bandmate.
So he's at this point, he's like 22, 23.
These are pretty straight ahead soul scorcher type material. Yeah. Like there's no pretensions of being anything other than what they are. But, you know, they're kind of like James Brown B-sides, but that's not bad. That's not a bad thing to shoot for.
Yeah, and he's kind of evolving pretty quick. It's pretty.
I give it 3 stars.
Okay.
This period. of two singles.
Okay. All right. Okay. Sure. 3. Okay.
3.
I swear.
Come on. Start an argument with me. Give it 0.
I have proper ratings for all the rest of everything. I didn't think we were rating these, but okay.
I rate everything. I even rated that stretch of conversation. I gave it 1.5 stars. All right. So in the mid '60s, after or during this part, or I should say, Stone DJ'd for KSOL, which is a San Francisco soul station. He began playing white acts like the Beatles and the Stones. And in 1964, when he was only 19, he was a record producer for Autumn Records and produced, mainly Caucasian San Francisco area bands such as the Beau Brummels.
And those records sound real good.
They're freaking great. They kind of sound like Dave Hassinger.
This is kind of like what I was getting at with him being a polymath. He's really young, but he's already got every aspect of, you know, he hasn't really written and like great music yet, but he's as a performer and producer.
He's got his fingers in everything.
He does everything, yeah.
Yeah, and he even produced The Great Society, which was Grace Slick's first band right before Airplane. I was going to say Starship. But most impressively, he produced the original version of Grace Slick's "Someone to Love," as it was initially called. Not quite as good as the Airplanes version became, but in 1966, here's where it begins. Okay, so
it's an interesting that as you bring that up, they're kind of part of that scene. They're kind of part of the San Francisco scene, on a kind of different wing of it, but he's kind of there as that's all happening, the Dead and Jefferson Airplane. They're contemporaries, but they're playing more in like the East Bay.
Right. They're playing outside, like on the periphery. Then what happened
was... But they occasionally intersect with it, you know, like in those early days.
But they're two bands.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So right now they're Sly's band, Sly and the Stoners, which included Cynthia Robinson on trumpet. She will come up during this, but she's the trumpet player and the one who sings in Dance to the Music, "Ah, you squares!" So distinctive, that voice. And she is really the one mainstay in Sly's life.
She goes incredibly patient on the whole bumpy
fucking ride. She's there at all points, and even bears one of his kids. So in any case, Sly and the Stoners was Sly and Cynthia, and then his brother Freddie had a band called Freddie and the Stone Souls with Greg Errico and Jerry Martini. Greg Errico played drums, Jerry Martini was a saxophonist.
By the way, I was yesterday years old when I realized it's pronounced Greg Errico.
Is it? You know what's funny? I always called it Errico, and the last few days you've been pronouncing it Errico, so I just switched.
Well, as I said, I was yesterday years
because
old.
Joe is a Mensa, and I didn't even argue the fact that he was correct, but it turns out Mensas can be incorrect. All right, you heard it here first. So
every time you get something wrong, you know, it's like, why are you walking around with that dollhouse on your head, Mensa? You know, you gotta hear it every time.
It's a curse. All right, so one night, the two bands were hanging out in Sly's kitchen, or Sly's parents' kitchen, and they decided to combine the bands together, as well as adding Larry Graham on bass. Larry Graham, P.S., always the outsider. Working the Bay Area in 1967, the group made a mark. In 1968, Rose Stone joined the band, and they became Sly and the Family Stone. Now we're off and running.
Classic lineup formed.
Here we are. January 1967, they released their first single, I Ain't Got Nobody, For Real, backed with I Can't Turn You Loose, which is a cover. To me, the thing that leaps out of the fucking speakers the second this starts, and by the way, this is a pre-album single. It's really just kind of a bonus track, but you'll find it on discography.com. Greg Errico is on fire.
Yeah.
I mean, his drum playing is insane.
Well, the rhythm section in general, they add a ton of, you know, it's a lot of firepower there. Those two guys, Larry Graham and Greg Errico, you know, classic, legendary, monstrous rhythm section.
But Joe, right out of the gate, the band is completely and fully formed. I mean, there's no tweaks to be made, basically.
Yeah, that's kind of what my reaction to it was. It's like, okay, this sounds like what they were. They came, you know, there's no, like, this isn't like a prototypical version of it. This is the actual, they're doing it right out of the gate.
Yeah.
They sound exactly like Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah, this
it
is
doesn't sound like an early version of Sly and
no,
the Family
it
Stone.
No, it doesn't. There's no nascent Sly.
Yeah.
There's nascent Sly solo. There's no nascent Family Stone. So anyway, from June to September 67, over the Summer of Love, Sly and the Family Stone recorded live in the studio. No overdubbing, apparently, or that might be mythological. Who the hell knows? But the idea was a live performance. And actually, you know, worthy of note, Clive Davis, who's, you know, a legend in the music industry, so you don't just ignore the dude, he wound up pressuring Sly to go in a more pop direction. And so after the recording of this record, which is called A Whole New Thing, and it was A Whole New Thing, they never followed up or developed this style of soul.
Yeah, I guess so. They kind of got back to it. They not really exactly like this. This was kind of like there's stuff on it that's almost like guitar pop, like garage psych kind of pop. Like this is really the when they're doing the kaleidoscopic vision sort of thing. This is kind of the most like that.
I think what's exciting about the record is, number one, during this time, there was no fully integrated band like this, you know, multiracial, cross-sexual. This had never been done before, and to write their own material. And then on this record, to be like a bag filled with Mexican jumping beans. I mean, so much, you know, it was bursting at the seams, basically.
Yeah, right, because you have, you know, Sly with a strong set of songs, and the band is just incendiary. The classic lineup, I mean, all the lineups, Sly always played with great musicians, and these guys who were like the kings of funk, they always attract the best of the best, because people want to go play with them.
Yeah.
But this particular band had not just great musicians, but the combination. Greg Errico is kind of like he's a great funk drummer, and he's played those classic breakbeats, but he has a heavy kind of sound, like almost like John Bonham or something.
Yeah. It feels like mallets. It really does.
It's a kind of a thunderous and kind of like very super energetic kind of sound.
Yeah.
And how
it works for this record specifically is because, you know, there's less of a pop vibe on this record than there is on Stand or Dance to the Music.
I don't mean this as a slight on Greg Errico at all, who is a 10 out of 10 amazing drummer. He has some rough edges to him. He has kind of a little bit of sloppy garagey stuff to him
Later
they play with Andy Newmark, who's, you know, Andy Newmark never plays a note or a fill that isn't perfect, you know, but
Gregory Rico, he's a basher.
He could be my favorite drummer of all time.
Yeah, he's amazing. I love this about his style.
He's fucking amazing.
Him being more spirited and kind of like rough around the edges, as opposed to being ultra slick or something. It gives them a garage kind of feel at times.
Yeah,
it gives them almost so like I don't want to say punk rock, but
we're barely into the actual songs here. So we'll move ahead from Rico because we haven't even talked about Sly's songs, which are amazing. This record is incredible. It's also, Joe, very generous.
Yeah,
I mean, he gives a lot of solos out to all the band.
Right.
You know, it is a little bit front loaded, the record. The first side is unbelievably good. And then it kind of downshifts into capable but unthrilling soul music. But regardless of the songwriting, the performances are ridiculously spirited. And the back and forth is fun as hell.
Yeah, it comes roaring out of the gate.
Yeah, Underdog is great. If This Room Could Talk with the Larry Graham solos showcase is fucking amazing. Run, 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 really peppy psych pop. That's amazing.
Yeah, that one's a real gem. That
could be my favorite on the record. I'm a sucker for that kind of shit.
Well, If This Room Can Talk is kind of like, it's sort of like a precursor to Everyday People to me. It has that kind of bouncy kind of feel to it. These songs all have, you know, those all the parts they're playing are great. Like they're really well rehearsed and well arranged. So like, you know, Turn Me Loose, the groove on that is just so tight. It's so like, and then it like, they could take it to a place where it almost falls off the rails. Like, great chemistry in playing on this record. It sounds kind of like what it is, which is they just had these songs very well rehearsed. These are probably the songs that were in their live set at the time. They went in and just knocked it out in the studio.
You know, this is a dude who was constantly creative, constantly coming up with new stuff. And yet through the 70s, you look, not only through the 70s, through the 80s. When he appeared on Letterman, he's doing old shit.
Yeah.
He could be doing new shit and have it be amazing, but he keeps giving in to that routine.
Well, I think a lot of that, though, by the time the late 70s and the 80s roll around, it's like that's all people really want to hear.
Right.
You know,
right.
People don't want to hear new stuff. And that's different than the early phase in his career when he was kind of bursting with ideas and he felt like pressured to do a certain kind of thing. I think the phase of his career...
I'm going to argue that the producers did not make him do old stuff, that he just thought that that's what they wanted to
hear. Yeah, I'm sure that's what he thought. Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, later in his career, he's got financial troubles. He's got to put the butts in the seats. He's got to. He's not dumb.
If you want a fast track to financial troubles, pick up a crack habit. I'll tell you that much. But I give this record 4 stars.
I gave it 4.
Yeah, it's great. So moving on to 1968, we have Dance to the Music, which is a Clive Davis assisted reaction to A Whole New Thing. So during the recording, the band didn't even think highly of it. So, you know, it really is directly attributable to Clive and his request to Sly to go in a more pop-friendly direction that it exists.
Yeah, this record's not as fun. It does have, you know...
it develops a formula.
Yeah, it got the big hit they wanted.
There's not much else. There's really not much else. To me,
the best thing I can say about this record, the bright side of this one is that there's still great playing on it. So some of the material is not really that amazing, but there are magical moments in it because the players are so good. They get a hold of a good groove, and it's like I kind of appreciate it more on that level. Like, oh, I like Greg's drums on this, or this one has a sick guitar lick in it. You know, like it's more.
And also the peace, love, and togetherness thing is coming together.
They're almost not really. They could sort of like just pick up instruments and randomly play a jam, and it's going to pretty much sound good. The thing is, there's kind of a.
And plus, you get all of them: Sly, Freddie, Rose, Larry jumping in on vocals. Yeah,
there's a high floor to their music. It never goes into like fully suck because they all play their asses off at all times.
So obviously the formula not only worked in selling records, but it influenced the entire music industry. I mean, it's funny because to me, I'm just going to say right up front, I think this is the worst album he ever did, and I give it 2 stars.
I liked it better than that. I gave it 3, and it is definitely there's not a ton of great material on it. There's a few
There's two songs. So there's Dance to the Music, which is great, but now it's an anthem to be played at bar mitzvahs, and I Ain't Got Nobody for Real, which is great, but inferior to the original 1967 single.
Right, yeah.
The medley's a piece of shit, and Sly had to have known it.
I kind of like the tune Color Me True. That one kind of has a good kind of like strut to it, sort of. But yeah, they're kind of every song you get the sense that they're trying to get like a dance party anthem, you know, going. And they hit on one of them. And I guess the formula sort of worked. And then
it worked for them. Look at what happened to the music. And I mean, you have Norman Whitfield at Motown. We'll get further into it later on as it really develops around Riot. But you have Norman Whitfield going on. You have the Jackson 5. Everyone's moving in that direction, and it's because of Sly. Yeah. All right, so moving on to later in 1968, we're on Life. So unlike Dance to the Music, Life was not a hit. So a lot of the songs on the album, including M'lady, Fun, Love City, and Life Itself, became definite staples in their live act. But it's kind of a middle ground between the crazy explosive energy of A Whole New Thing and the more commercially driven Dance to the Music.
Yeah, I found this one to be kind of in the same vein as Dance to the Music. Maybe a little bit.
I think it's better.
It's better. I think the songs are a little stronger. But it seems like it has the same kind of goals. It's kind of going for the peppy kind of party stuff.
Yeah. But the problem for me, right out of the gate, it shits the bed. You've got Dynamite, which blows. Chicken blows and Plastic Gym blows. This is not a good intro.
The sequencing is weird.
It sucks.
Yeah.
But there's great songs on the record. Fun.
Yeah.
That's really good. It's basically Stand Light, but it's the first good track, and it comes four songs into the week beginning the record. Into My Own Thing is awesome with a sick fucking intro. Definitely proto Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Harmony. More 60s message funk, and then Life, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Circus celebration of living woke and self-empowered. Love City and M'lady. That's a really good one.
That's kind of a lot. Yeah. So, you know, Love City, you know what that breakbeat was used on, right?
What?
The sample. Sissy Neck by Beck.
Oh, sweet.
Samples that beat.
Love City's great. It's a track that pops up a lot on live stuff, especially like around 68. There's a lot of stuff with it.
Yeah, that's a cool song. So most of this record I knew, the songs that are, I had when I was maybe like, I don't know, freshman year in college or something, I feel like I got a Sly and the Family Stone comp. That was like a greatest hits that was probably put out like in the 80s. And it had the three songs. It had Fun, Life, and M'lady were, I think, all on that compilation. And that and Love City seem like the tunes that I'm still kind of responding to from this. There's one really cringy song, Jane is a Groupie.
Yeah, that's not good. Super, and that isn't that the last song?
That's not
I think
cool.
It's the last song, yeah.
No,
but at that time it was cool, which is fucked up. It's like,
I think it's what the kids call cringe AF, but
yeah,
then cringe has no E on
it. It's like changing the Mrs. Butterworth bottle.
Yeah.
All right, so anyway,
that one, all right,
now we're into 1969, and now we're into juicy motherfucking territory, Joe, because May 1969, the transitional stuff is over, and the Sly and the Family Stone, at least for the moment, is a very, very complete entity. First of all, sold over 3 million copies altogether. It's one of the most successful albums of the 60s. There is something right out of the gate you have to accept about it. There's some of the greatest songs of all time, and I'm talking six great songs, and then you have to accept two songs that are kind of unnecessary but not objectionable. Would you agree with that, Joe?
Yeah, well, I like this album a lot. It's definitely a classic, iconic funk album. This is they're most successful, right? This is like their most commercially successful album.
Yeah, well, I think Riot was actually, but not quite sure to be quite.
This is kind of the most hit-packed album.
Yeah,
this to me, they're getting back to where they were on A Whole New Thing, where it's like it seems like the constraints are kind of off. It seems like it has more freedom. I mean, maybe because he's had the hit song, you know.
But all the best stuff is reined in.
Right. But, I mean, this is chock full of, there's at least five or six really iconic,
All the best songs share the sense of like nursery rhyme homilies that are being used. That all the lyrics, I mean, every line is a quotable event. But
also some fierce funk licks and shit on this. There's some the outro for Stand and like.
But the outro, you know about the outro on Stand?
That was kind of improvised or something, right?
So the band wasn't in the studio. So it's that end piece, which is legendary, is a different band. It's like session players. Yeah. Oh, isn't that funny?
That is, yeah.
Let's just say right out of the gate that we have Sex Machine, which is like 15 minutes that could have been utilized with great other songs. Right. And Don't Call Me N-Word, Whitey. That one too is more of a '60s event.
Yeah, musically, it's not really that interesting.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
it's not. It's more of a Shockeroony.
Yeah.
But this record is the pinnacle of the uplifted sloganeering phase of the band. Right out of the gate, we've got Stand. This is feeling totally different, Josefina, assured and hitting its lyrical and musical targets with ease. And then the coda that you talked about, that 49-second piece, is just like seemingly tossed off, but that in itself could have been a 10-minute song.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Stan, what a well-written song across the board. I mean, the melody, chord changes, lyrics, I mean, it's, you know,
and then I think
top rate.
The best song of Sly's career in this early phase is easily I Want to Take You Higher.
Well, I mean, the groove.
It's just insane. It's off the charts.
To this day, like, blasts out of the speakers. It kicks in that guitar lick, like, right? Like, that's one of the sickest intros.
It's
kicks
amazing.
Mega ass.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite songs of all time. So Somebody's Watching You is where, Joe, I'm curious if you agree with me on this. This is where, like, the paranoia seeds were sown. So it's candy-coated in terms of how the music is and how the lyrics are very nursery rhymey.
It's kind of a quirky, kind of a quirky little funk track. Like.
I think it's watered down Riot if you really listen to it. So, you know, ever stop to think about a downfall?
Yeah,
happens at the end of every line.
Yeah,
that's basically.
And it's kind
of here's
how
my career is going to go.
It's out of character. It's an interesting curveball with the rest of the record, which is kind of this very up with people kind of.
It's interesting that it's like the ultimate up '60s vibe.
Yeah,
but here's like here's a foreshadowing.
Yeah,
because the nicer the nice, the higher the price. This is what you pay for what you need.
Yeah,
that's a lyric from the fucking song. That's it. He planted the truth.
He's
right
a pretty
in his...
interesting lyricist.
Yeah,
I think,
yeah.
Stand has some great lines in it. You know, Stand, you've been sitting way too long. There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong.
These are great lyrics. Yeah, he's an absolute poet, as he refers to himself on Riot. Sing a Simple Song, Everyday People, which we don't even need to go. I mean, that's. Talk about how many commercials was that in?
One of the incredible things about Everyday People is that the chord never changes. It's just the same bass notes throughout. It never moves off that pedal.
He could probably write that shit in his sleep because I know at that time he was really interested.
But it doesn't
in
seem like it. It doesn't seem like it. It doesn't seem static at all. You know,
it doesn't.
Because all the vocal parts that come in just send chills up your spines. They're so amazing. The way they're sang and the arrangement of the vocals and the backup vocals. It doesn't need chord changes.
And then you can make it if you try. I mean, what a way to end the record. Yeah. So this is a great album. You know what?
That's another one where you can make it if you try. The vocal arrangement, the way everybody sings on that, and the way all their voices, it's just moi.
So just moving on to, by the way, I give it 5 stars, unquestionably.
I gave it 4.5, only because of the
fillery ones,
but you can definitely make a case for 5. It's classic.
But here's the thing. It's kind of like the way that I feel about Saucer Full of Secrets.
Mm-hmm.
The whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, it's very.
So to me, it's a 5-star record.
I'm not going to quibble with a 5. It's amazing.
Regardless of the, I'm not trying to convince you otherwise, but I thought about it for days. And then I went with the 5.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so August 1969, August 17th, 1969, Sly and the Family Stone set went down during the early morning hours, and their performance was, this is saying quite a lot.
It's We're talking about Woodstock.
Yeah, Woodstock.
Here.
It's probably the best of the entire festival. The myth is the actual reality in this very rare case. So Joe, he was so on fucking fire. It was 3 a.m, and he had hundreds of thousands of hippies in the palm of his hand. Is this the height of Sly Stone's life and career?
I mean, it's certainly an amazing performance. It's too bad there isn't more footage of the Sly band at this crazy high peak. There's a lot more stuff that you can find of them later. But
the weird thing to me is, okay, and there's like, it's like a double-edged sword to me, is I saw Summer of Soul, great performance, but I was struck by how similar it was to the Woodstock performance. Yeah.
And that was their set. That's what they did.
I know, but it made me feel like, because there was no other footage, it made me feel like the feeling was more ersatz inside of it.
Yeah, but you know, you got to remember at the time, there's no YouTube, there's no concert films of things. So anybody right. that's seeing it is experiencing that
for the first time.
So to be able to do it night after night,
but not in 1974.
Yeah, true.
And it's a little bit old.
Yeah, but at that time,
yeah,
you know, when they're able to get it to that crazy high level at every show, you know, it's like that's what they, you know, that's kind of what you would expect them to do. You know?
So then they're still on their pinnacle. It's August 69. Hot Fun in the Summertime comes out, Joe yeah. Kennedy. And that was just, that went to number 2, and that's just a great song.
Yeah,
it's great.
I mean,
I give it 5 fucking stars, Joe.
Sure. As a single, that's an easy 5-star single.
Easy.
And it's just got that breezy groove to it. It's like the little chord lick is amazing. You know, it's everybody sings great. Again, amazing vocal arrangements, you know.
And then it's kind of.
If you don't like that song, you know, I don't know what to really tell you.
We kind of groove in toward the end of the year then. Now it's. December 69, we got Altamont going down, unrelated to Sly, but that vibe is in the air. And in December 69, the very first, you know, truly like taking a left turn in their direction, this is where it occurs. So thank you for letting me be myself again. Backed with Everybody is a Star, which is a ridiculously great single. That marks the beginning of the Family Stone's second era, during which the music took on a significantly darker, more funk-based vibe, more like a junky bummer music.
I get, yeah, sure. This is kind of a transitional phase to that. I mean, a classic single, 2 amazing songs. I mean, most of our listeners probably know these. These are very iconic singles. You know, Thank You is kind of like in that I Want to Take You Higher kind of space, where it's just the most fierce groove. You know, with a nice catchy hook over it, but the quality of the funk is just, you know, there's nobody else that can match
it's
it.
It's an outstanding time. Song, and you know, obviously Larry Graham, this is one of those, you know, what was the moment that invented punk, but this is the moment that invented the slap.
Yeah,
bass,
it's
correct?
Got the great slap lick, you know, classic. You know, it's.
I just think you found your second career, motherfucker.
Scat slap singing?
Yes. but yeah, the bass playing's great. Apparently,
and it's got the slamming Gregorico. It's that the rhythm section really shines in that one. There, you know, this was kind of their last hurrah. That rhythm section.
Apparently, just as a side note, Larry Graham invented this style because he was in a band that didn't have a drummer, mm-hmm. so wanted a percussive effect.
Right.
Yeah, this was. This was a turning point because after this song, after this single, things started to change in terms of where they went. So,
yeah, they started to get less band oriented. It started to be less like we are the 6 people that play on this or whoever.
But not initially. Yeah. I don't know.
But it started. This is the kind of the apex.
So
of where
Thank
really
You
a band.
Was intended to be part of an album with Everybody's a Star and Hot Fun in the Summertime. And there was an interview he did at the time where Sly described the album as that he was making as the most optimistic of all, and that it was reportedly titled The Incredible and Unpredictable Sly and the Family Stone. Needless to say, the LP was never finished or possibly
that's
never worked
them,
on to start
that's
with.
Part of the unpredictability.
Exactly. You know, it's like Sid Barrett's Have You Got It Yet? And the 3 tracks instead were folded into the band's 1970 Greatest Hits LP, which is important because that's the record company saying, we give up on you.
Yeah, that's what that kind of meant at the time when it was like a contractual fulfillment.
But it was
thing.
A huge seller. That album sold 1 trillion in copies. Literally 1 trillion. It's the biggest selling album. It's quite.
Everybody on earth bought 4
So.
Wait, no, if it took 1 trillion, yeah, every people on earth bought like 1,000 copies or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that.
Thank you, and Everybody is a Star, with the final Family Stone recordings issued in the 60s. And they marked the beginning of a 23-month period of radio silence from the band, which would finally end in 1971 with Family Affair. The demand for new music was deafening. Sly greeted this fever pitch with silence, total silence. Something went wrong here, Joe. Something went terribly wrong here. Where did things begin to change? So their manager, David Kuprelik, thought the turning point was a Fillmore E show where Sly didn't allow any individual solos.
That seems like a weird thing for it to be a turning point.
Well, that dude, you know what happened to that dude eventually? Let's just go to the end of his life.
Yeah.
He had a nervous breakdown, tried to commit suicide three times, moved to Hawaii, left the record industry, thanks to Sly.
Yeah, that's how he exits the Sly
That's
stage.
How he exits. Okay, so.
He gave it the old college try for
That's
a while.
The perspective of a guy who did those things. All right, so then there were the drugs, Joe. The drugs. So every
that seems like the more likely culprit.
Let's talk about the drugs, okay?
But what do you think it was that caused the meltdown of Sly and the Family Stone? You think it was drugs or that one show where they didn't get to play solo?
It had to have been the non-solo show. Okay, so every other band on the planet is smoking tons of weed, is experimenting with psychedelics, and is possibly dabbling in cocaine and heroin. Nobody is doing PCP. Nobody. Nobody wants to.
Well, one but guy is.
The only person who's doing PCP is somebody who accidentally bought a bag of some other drug that was laced with PCP. So Sly liked PCP. And the introduction of that on the scene, plus tons of downer pills. He would buy them by the 500. And coke definitely did not help matters. So
it started adding some, start adding some randomness to the equation.
Yeah, then everything kind of got really out of hand. But then to make matters even more insidious and creepy, Sly was the one who doled out the lines. Other people weren't allowed to have drugs in the band. He sat behind, I mean, this sounds like a fucking movie, but he sat behind a desk in a library, like a darkly lit library, apparently, and served his people. So when Sly closed up and went upstairs, the shop was closed.
It's like a Vito Corleone kind of thing.
It's absolutely crazy. So there was a guy on the scenes that basically said that nobody was allowed to have their own blow. So that was...
How do you, like, enforce that exactly?
But, I mean, so what... He kind of set up his house like a casino. No clocks allowed. So he ruined the sense of time, as he alluded to in his songs over and over again. He kind of decimated and recreated time in his image. And had all these people liquidate their lives in the Bay Area and then come down to a scene in L.A. that they thought was going to be the incredible and wild and unpredictable world of Sly and the Family Stone. And it was like this dark, gangster-ridden drug den. It was completely insane. So then there were the thugs, the drugs and the thugs. So this new guy on the scene.
Not
was,
enough hugs.
No, we need more hugs. Thugs, drugs, and hugs. So this guy named Hamp Bubba Banks entered the scene around this time as Sly's right-hand man and basically main person, like manager. He got the bedroom next to Sly at their Bel Air house after forcibly taking it from Jerry Martini, who had sold his house after being convinced from Sly that this was the way to go. Bubba acted as the door guard if you wanted to talk to Sly.
So this was also the house that it was in Bel Air, right? So they
783 is, Bel Air.
So this was John Phillips and Michelle Phillips had been previously living there.
And Jerry Martini, the saxophonist, thinks that it was the move from San Francisco to 783 Bel Air Road in the fall of 69 that made the band's trajectory go directly downward.
And so he also built I guess John Phillips had built a studio in there.
So it was built initially for Jeanette McDonald, the actress, and then in 65 she died. John and Michelle bought it in 67, outfitted with this recording studio that was in the attic. And like young Frankenstein, you had to access it through a bookcase.
You could pull out like a certain book and then the...
Put the candle back at the bookers. So Sly rented the place from John for $12,000 a month. And putting $25,000 in an escrow account every few months. so he could record an album there. So check this out. John fucking Phillips winds up inadvertently leaving behind his kids' birth certificates and an ounce of cocaine. So that inadvertently set the mood.
Well, they're probably together in like the same box.
Yeah, exactly. Those two.
You ever
go
do
together.
That before you move, and you move somewhere, and you're like, oh, this box that had like our steak knives, and whatever happened
like
to
toward
it?
The end of moving when you stop categorizing things. So Jerry Martini said the house was super, was very gangsterish, dangerous. The vibes were very dark at that point. There was a cloud flying over the place. There was a cloud flying over Sly from the time he moved down to Los Angeles. To
what
this
about
day. To this day? Same cloud. End right. quote. I became a coke addict, drug addict, vegetable, sitting around waiting for my line like the rest of the assholes. That's Jerry Martini's words precisely.
And then John and Michelle had those peacocks.
They had peacocks who would be walking on the roof that would be jumping on unsuspecting visitors.
For those of you who don't know, peacocks are assholes. They will attack you.
And just to also let you know, I scaled the wall at 783 Bel Air Road several years ago to attempt to look down into this legendary rock palace. And it was pretty stunning. Pretty stunning. I wish I'd jumped off the wall and gone in. But basically, you know, and the cherry on top of this cake, let's talk about Gunn for a second. Gunn was Sly's pit bull.
Oh, man.
And he was supposedly trained to kill. Sly also had a baboon, but Gunn killed the baboon and then fucked it.
Bad dog.
Yeah, bad dog. Sly loved to liven up recording sessions by throwing Gunn in the mix and watching everyone run for dear life.
I wish this story had a better outcome.
Right, right. So obviously, based on this vibe, relationships within the band were falling apart, in particular between the Stone Brothers and Larry Graham.
They're also recording in there at the same time, a lot. So he's got his. They're doing some work at the record plant, I guess.
They would do tons of drugs and then record for days.
Well, it seems like what went on at the house from like researching all that stuff for the purposes of this episode, he's recording some of the stuff from that Stoneflower era is yeah. going on at the house, and then he's making some of. He's doing some of what would eventually be the next album.
He's doing some pretty astounding production stuff.
It seems
totally
like it's kind of like that. A whoever happens to be around, if you want to come play on stuff, you can come play. It doesn't seem like it's like so much like the Family Stone is the house band there, really. It seems like whoever feels like dropping by.
The first production was
it
Joe
It seems
Hicks.
Like come by, do some drugs, go up in the studio, we'll make some stuff. Sure. It's not being properly archived. There are just like tapes laying around and nobody knows who
played on
There's
what.
There's probably to this day... God knows how many dozens of hundreds of hours of sessions from
a digital dump from that time would just be such a beautiful earful.
Yeah, so it seems like they're working on stuff almost kind of randomly.
Yeah, but as far as releases go, the very first one from Stoneflower Productions was Joe Hicks in September 69. You have I'm Going Home on the first side and Home Sweet Home. I give this 4 stars. That was kind of an intro for his production work. Did you like that song?
Yeah, that's kind of especially the tune, the Home Sweet Home tune, is kind of like a James Brown style funk. Yeah, I mean, it's the same. It's the you know, very gritty funk playing on that. Cool tune.
Yeah. Yeah. And then around this time, Gregorico was the first one to quit. So the only place he can, just as a side note, that he can really hear his drumming on Riot is the very last track, Thank You for Talking to Me, Africa, which was the only real group performance. So Errico was replaced by a guy named Jerry Gibson, who was the Banana Splits drummer and apparently played with mallets.
Yeah, short-lived replacement.
That was short-lived. But Stone was becoming really erratic around this time. Errico was gone. Then these cheap tinny drum machines enter the picture and point the way toward Riot. In late 69, Africa was an outtake. It was an original version of Africa Talks to You that seems to be the first evidence of the new style.
Yeah, he's the drum machine stuff's pretty interesting. It's a Maestro Rhythm King Mark II, which I had that box in my household when I was a little kid. My dad has one. I think still owns it.
And that sound still sounds wonderful.
Yeah, well, it's
primitive as hell, but amazing.
Yeah, so there's kind of like a row of buttons, then there's maybe like 20, 25 different beats you can play on it. And the sounds themselves are these kind of like the hi-hats have a very specific kind of hiss to them. They're just kind of a white noise hiss, like a it's kind of the Rhythm King hi-hat.
And almost like a bubbling.
Well,
the
the other sounds, like the other like toms and congas or whatever, all have this kind of rubbery kind of sound.
They have
to
this
them.
Weird definition that somehow hasn't been recreated.
It sounds like kind of rubbery to me. It's this kind of like, you know, like
it's
a
the,
bouncy,
it's,
bubbly
it's the
kind
ultimate
of thing.
For funk. I mean, it seems
well,
like the
ultimate thing that's
for
interesting
funk.
Is the beats that are on this machine and the ones that Sly uses are usually not syncopated or funky in their own right. They're usually just like very vanilla 4/4 kind of straightforward. You only can play the beats that have come with the thing, you know, that you can't program
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
It's what's laid on top of it. It goes to show you that funk isn't necessarily built around the drums being syncopated. You can have the drums playing something kind of very straightforward, four on the floor, you know, very standard 2/4, 4/4 kind of, you know, eighth note beats, nothing too fancy, but it's the other stuff being on top of it that's syncopated.
Yeah.
And that has its own kind of funk to it. It's everything else on it. It has this foundation of this like very
static
drum thing.
We're starting to go in a whole other direction because with Little Sister, which is his, which is Vaeta's group, his sister, You're the One comes out in January 1970. That is the very first release with this new drum machine sound. It wasn't with his band. He wasn't really recording with his band right now. Then Little Sister in November 1970 released Stanga.
Great tune.
Amazing. And then on the B-side, Somebody's Watching You, which is a redone, stripped-down, spectral, spooky-as-fuck version of Somebody's Watching You from Stand. All that stuff I give 5 stars.
Sure, I love all those.
It's amazing.
There's proto. Well, we're kind of foreshadowing to the slot. To There's a Riot Going On. Spoiler alert: that album is coming up. But there.
I want to quote a lyric that Sly wrote for Stanga. Sometime or another, gonna feel the pain. Sometime or another, you gotta see the rain. Sometime or another, you're gonna be stung. Sometime or another, you might see a brother hung. Now we're starting to get into Riot-type paranoia territory.
Yeah, this isn't different folks, different strokes
this is a
for different
whole,
folks.
Yeah, exactly. This is not you can make it if you try. It's you cannot make it. Why would you try? So,
true.
It's got its Stan sheen flayed right off to expose the paranoid studs under the 60s gloss. And no, I'm not even reading from my notes.
And you can see this the gradual transition of what... You know, what became the Riot era kind of happening. Things are getting dark with the drugs. There's a crazy house atmosphere going on where the records are being made. There's other transitional experimental things he's doing with other artists that kind of inform the later record, you know, inform Riot.
Joe Hicks is the next one. Mm-hmm. So Life and Death and G&A, that's in December 70.
Right.
Great song. 5 stars.
Super cool. Noticeably, if
it feels good, it's all right.
Right. It has the classic hedonism of the next phase.
It sums up Riot before Riot even comes out. And then you have a group
There's
called,
a difference between optimism and hedonism. You know, it's a fine line kind of, but they're kind of tilting into that direction.
Yeah, but once you cross that line, it becomes the antithetical to the first.
Yeah.
So the number six with IX, they released a song that I believe Sly wrote, I'm Just Like You, and on the B-side, Dynamite. I give that 4 stars. That was in December 70. Kind of a commercial twist on the new drum machine sound.
Yeah, well, these are all, these almost function as like Riot going on B-sides because it seems like they're done from the same sessions, the same kind of place and time. And, you know, Riot is a very specific place and time kind of record, and these exist in that same world.
However, right around the corner, things started to get really fucked up in a way that is completely unpredictable and completely out of bounds. We are going to wrap up on this episode and on our next episode of Sly and the Family Stone. You'll see what happens in 1970 when Sly completely flies off the rails.
Check us out on discography.com. There will be some bonus material and playlists for this episode. And definitely come back and revisit us for part 2 of Sly and the Family Stone.